time for Taking Care of Business on Midlands 103. With thanks to the local enterprise offices of Leash, Offaly and Westmeath. Find us on localenterprise.ie and let's talk business.
Midlands 103.
Hello and a very good evening to you all. It's Tuesday, the 6th of September. I'm Ronan Berry and you're very welcome to Taking Care of Business here on Midlands 103. I hope you're sitting comfortably, or if you're driving, sit back and listen, because tonight we're going to get you some great advice from businesses. I have in front of me in the studio at the minute a man who has a vast amount of experience over about 4 decades in factories and in manufacturing and how to eliminate and reduce waste. A very, very important topic right now. More on that in just a couple of minutes. I'll also be joined by Offaly man and former professional rugby player Peter Bracken. Peter took on a quest recently where he pledged to go in a fully electric car to all 240 rugby clubs across the country. Now, he's doing so to try to raise awareness of sustainability and try to see what role sport can play in raising our own awareness around what we need to do and what can be done as well. So I'm really looking forward to delving into that around 7:30 to see what Peter's experience has been like so far. I think he's either finished or is almost finished his journey, and see what it was actually like trying to navigate a fully electric car all around the country. Were there any infrastructural challenges? Did he suffer range anxiety? So lots to happen there and find out how Peter's journey has been going. And then later on, of course, it's time to celebrate a little bit. And who doesn't need a celebration right now? Well, I can tell you one thing for sure. The hospitality sector deserves a celebration. It has been, to say the least, a challenging couple of years for that sector. So the good news was announced yesterday that the Midlands 103 Hospitality Awards were unveiled again and are open for nomination. So if you've got a favourite bar, restaurant, tourism activity, a favourite bar person, restaurant manager, whatever it might be, you can now nominate them for a hospitality award. Find out how you can do that a little bit later in the show. Lots to come here, say, between now and 8 p.m. If you'd like to get in touch with me here in the studio, you can do so, as always, by text or WhatsApp on 083 3010 103. That, of course, is powered by the home of Offaly's top-selling car brand, Lamb Brothers Toyota, the Arden Road in Tullamore. But I suppose it's the ever-pressing topic in our personal lives and our business lives at the minute is this whole issue of cost, with inflation, with just the rising cost of operating a business. It has been on the rise significantly over the past year, none more so than in the last couple of months, when, you know, not only are prices increasing, but where the limits are on those prices is anybody's guess at this point. It doesn't look like anything is coming down. The need to eliminate waste in your business processes has always been a very, very important factor of successful business, particularly when it comes to factories and ensuring that factories are sustainable and that they can keep operating. Because yes, we're one of the top countries in the world in terms of FDI. We need all our factories operating, though, to that global standard, because yes, jobs are created, but sometimes jobs are lost when factories close. And there can be a myriad of issues as to why that can happen. But often sometimes it can come just from purely operational issues. There are solutions to these challenges, though, too. And my first guest this evening has a lot of those. He's just published them into a book, which he'll take us through in a little while. But to get an extent of his backstory, too, and just his journey through manufacturing and advanced manufacturing, not just in Ireland, but right across the world, and his experience that, I say, he has collated and put into this book, I'm delighted to be joined by Liam Cassidy of Altix Consultancy. And Liam has been a manager in factories over the world and is credited with turning around the fortunes of many, many factories. He's just published a book called Make Your Factory Great and Keep It That Way. Sounds very simple, but Liam's story begins actually in the hills of Donegal. But in his late teens, early 20s, he actually arrived in Mullingar in County Westmeath. Very good evening, Liam. Take us through those early days from Donegal and tell us how you ended up in Mullingar.
Good evening, Roman. Thank you for having me here.
It's my great pleasure. Well, yeah, hills of Donegal for sure. Yeah, I was born in Muncrana and raised in about a mile or so outside a small village called Kilmacrennan in Donegal, which is not so far from Letterkenny. And it was the side of a hill, really, surrounded by small farmers, hill farmers. We were a military family, but we were hunted out to work on the fields by our mother regularly to support the neighbours. And they were a terrific community. There were music was a big thing. Every house had a fiddle or two on the wall, and sometimes an accordion in the corner or something. But I dropped out of school at 16. I didn't find it so great, and at that time, my education came later. And I lied about my age and joined the army in Mullingar, the 4th FA Regiment and the Artillery Regiment. And I spent 3.5 years there, and the half year is a bit odd because I was actually going overseas for the second time, but it was getting a bit close to my official discharge or re-signing time, so they extended it by 6 months. They did that in those days, which was quite generous when you think about it. So it was a, you know, at the time, I was 16, 17, going in 17 or something, you know, you get in there, you just get stuck into whatever is in front of you, a great adventure. Training was tough at times, but you just knuckle down. There was 8 of us to a room or to a billet, as it was called, and we just got through it. And after a year, I was less than a year, I was overseas in Cyprus, which was a great adventure way back in the 60s. And that was just such a huge thrill. You know, we were living under canvas, 6 of us to a tent, and I think I included it in the book, but you know, this discipline of a place for everything and everything in this place, which was really the forerunner to 5S when that was introduced. I was introduced to years later. You just became disciplined at looking after your kit and not impinging on the guy next to you, because that, you know, that just wasn't acceptable.
And crucially too, I guess, you only had the kit that you needed. You didn't carry any excess.
Overseas, for sure. Back down in Mullingar, we had a wardrobe, we had a bedside locker, but you know, there was distances, formal distances between your bed space and other bed spaces, and they had to be observed. So, you know, I didn't realise it at the time, but it was later on that I realised just what great habits and great things I learned there. You know, you learned about teamwork, which is so essential in any workplace. You learn how to take care of yourself. You know how to operate in or out of a team. You learn to know disciplines, you know, be on time if there can be consequences. Sometimes you just wonder, are there consequences today for almost anything? You know, in the workplace, the expectations are just all over the place. But we certainly had those kind of disciplines, and they've done me no harm at all.
Take us from the time then you left the army, and it essentially began a journey through manufacturing facilities across the world. How did you move from being a soldier into getting into factories in the first place?
Yeah, I remember I was, you know, should I sign on? Some of my friends did, some of my friends didn't. And I remember being interviewed by a Commandant O'Donnell, and he said to me, you know, why was I leaving? The army could offer me a good career. Where was I going? And I said, well, probably Australia. And that was on my head at the time. But I said, well, if you can guarantee me 2 of every 3 years abroad with the UN, I'll stay. But he couldn't do that, so off I went. And myself and another guy left, and we went to London. We thought en route to Australia. We said we'd give it a 6 months or so. We never did. Well, I didn't get out of London for a long time, nor did he. And so it turned out I was there for 7 years, and we just wandered into manufacturing by accident. We were being sent by this agency for an interview somewhere, and we saw this factory, big gates and signs up for all sorts of jobs that we didn't understand. And we hopped off the bus and went in, and we came out shortly after having signed contracts. And I remember we looked at each other and said, well, what is your job? And what is my job? We didn't know what we were going to be doing. So, but it was terrific because people liked the people with military backgrounds. They liked the fact that they were, you know, they bring some discipline, they could work within teams. They were going to be there when they said they were going to be. And, you know, that helped no end. And I was only in there a very short time. And I was in this room dipping materials into this liquid for a special cleaning process. And it was just a mess when I went there. So my dad tidied it up, just like we were taught to do at home in our kitchen after us. And particularly in Mullingar, where, you know, you just did not leave a mess behind you. You cleaned up everything. Everything was polished and spick and span. So, you know, I just done that and done some things, put up some signs. And one day the foreman came in and said, you know, I've heard some great things about what you're doing here. And then he went away and got his boss. And they asked me, would I be interested in going to into this other department, which was management development, enter their management development program. I said, that sounds okay. So I did. And then they asked me, would I, you know, so they sent me on to technical college. And it kind of took from there. So and so we were supposed to spend a number of weeks or months on a number of topics, which like production control, planning, progress chasing and marketing and so forth. And I only got through a few of them. One day somebody came in and said, you know, they were looking for somebody to fill in production as a supervisor because somebody had taken ill. So I said, okay, I'll have a go. And without, I wasn't even 20. I was just barely 20. And suddenly I was on a production line with 35 people, all women in those days on the line, making speedometers. And it was that was a learning experience because the systems were poor, but I didn't even know what a system should look like in those days. But some of the strong women took me under their wing and, you know, kept me on the straight and narrow. I'll always be grateful for that because, you know, these three or four of those should have been running the line before me. But in those days...
Yeah, the assumption is obviously the senior personnel were men.
It took, yeah, absolutely. All the offline jobs, higher grades were for... were for men, and it would take some years for that to change. So I spent 2.5 years there, and I began to think a bit more. You know, why is material supply so erratic? I remember I would go down to the warehouse, and they're putting our kits together, and they would have too much of this and not enough of that. So I was getting a bit more interested in materials management and supply chain. And somebody told me that GM through their AC Delco division were advertising wanted to get planners. So I applied. Done an interview, signed up, military background, right away was taken into another room. They were interested in that. And so I jumped two levels. They made me a senior planner. And I didn't know what a planning, what was that supposed to be? So they were commuting us out to Dunstable for 6 months, supposed to be for 6 weeks. Took 6 months out in Dunstable, a small town about 25 miles from London, out the M1. And then back into London, and this lady who was my assistant, who was middle-aged, her husband had been in the war, so she knew all the things that I didn't know, and she imparted them to me without any bitterness or complaining or anything else. So I had something like, I think it was 3,200 items, and I was sending schedules to two factories in Liverpool, one in Southampton, and a few other independent vendors. And it was computers. It was the very early days of the computers. So we got a printout and we just had to manually adjust that with the knowledge that the local planning people had. I had no knowledge to start with, but my assistant had an encyclopedic knowledge. So we were able to adjust the schedule. So it taught me some lessons about planning that you will never get a good forecast. People always talk about forecasts. If it's 30 to 40% accurate, get on with it. You know, it's as good as it's going to get. And then your local knowledge as your local planning department will apply their knowledge to adjusting that up or down and sending it off to their suppliers.
At what point did you see the work you were doing in those factories maybe being rolled out in other parts of that factory or that company?
Oh, I mean, I wasn't doing anything magical in those days. I was just getting by. I mean, I remember... I looked at a forecast one time and my assistant was on holiday and suddenly I think I went up to Liverpool and there was a phone call and I was hauled into an office and why was I setting up night shifts in Liverpool? And I said, I'm not setting up night shifts in Liverpool. They said, you are, your demand is way out of kilter. You've given them too high a forecast. I was making all sorts of mistakes, but I don't know, okay, they're promoting me twice. For I used to wonder why are they promoting me, but you know they must have seen something. And I remember then my general manager came down to see me one day and he said, you know that we're building a factory in Dublin. He says, are you interested in going over there? So yeah, I says, why not? You know, I said we'd go for a year. I'd met my future wife at that stage, and who was from Wexford. And we said, yeah, and she was very keen to go back anyway. I was sort of, you know, iffy. But they said, we'll go for a year and we'll see how it'll work out. So I went to the Packard Electric Division in Tala. And I suppose that's where I really began to learn about, you know, the nuts and bolts of what's involved here. I was running the warehouse and shipping areas. So I got to know about, you know, imports, exports. There was a lot of documentation. This was in the pre Eurozone days when there were only six countries in the European Union that went back then, and there was borders everywhere when you were shipping goods. And a lot of the time we were over and back to the docks trying to get stuff cleared. And then my boss asked me would I move into production. I did. And my experience in London was really valuable to me then. So, you know, I started to put in some visual stuff without really calling it visual. But, you know, I began to put in some controls where people would record what they were doing and record their lost time. And then we began to, you know, look at that and say, well, what can we do about that? So I was deemed to be successful there. Then I was moved over to what was called final assembly. And a year later, I was promoted to take the entire as head of production. And, you know, I was, I think, 32 then, which was considered young for a job like that in GM. And so for a time, you know, things were terrific. But there was a lot of IR activity that was beginning to develop there. There was a non-enlightened management view, I would say. We had, I think, six plant managers in 4 years or something, a large number of. So it was very hard to get continuity. And there were several senior managers there that in today's environment, I would have them out the door and on a one-way ticket because they were not contributing. And in fact, they were more interested in their personal careers rather than the greater good.
At what point did you become aware then of, say, Lean and the Lean toolkit as well? Because you're talking around a similar time when some of the kind of foremost thinkers of that kind of started really. Were you kind of doing it unknown to yourself? Or when did the companies you were working for begin to realize, well, actually, there is a system here, there's kind of a globally recognized system here that we can tap into?
Yeah, and it was called world-class manufacturing then, Ronan. And I got wind of it, first of all, at the IMI. I was on a program there, which was a 2-year, 18-month program. And people were talking about it. One of the tutors was you know, investigating it and researching it and giving us some stuff. And suddenly, you know, doors began to open here that, you know, process is very important. People are very important. You know, in the auto world, where I was at that time GM, people were treated not well. They weren't asked their opinions. There were numbers, you know, there was maybe up to 20, 30, 40 sometimes on an assembly line. The old-fashioned industrial engineering approach, you come out, you break it down, you've got 32 seconds to do this. You're not worried about what happens up there, down there. Get it done. You know, people people don't respond well to that. So, you know, I and others began to question that. So then I devoured any material I could find. And then this opportunity arose where, you know, we were running out of space. And so I was given this project, the first big project of its kind that I was to lead. It was $350,000, which is not a lot of money even back then. But I felt that, you know, this was an opportunity to really transform our warehouse and create a new manufacturing system. So I said, okay, so we brought people together, the key people who were going to be this stuff on the ground. We'd done what now would be called a Kaizen, improvement. And we said, you know, what do we need to do here? You know, what's the best approach? So we were taking the warehouse people into account, other key providers and so forth. So we came up with this plan and we just transformed our warehouse into what's called supermarket principles. It was the first warehouse of its kind with these supermarket principles in the world of GM. So in other words, you didn't need forklift trucks. You would go there, you'd walk around with a trolley, fill up the materials into slots that were labelled, and you bring them out and you wheel them into the production line and you take the trolley away and fill it up. So it was just constant cycle. And it just transformed the whole performance. We went from something like, was it maybe in our 60s or 70s of customer service, you know, to late 80 to 98%, just like easy. And turnover went up to 20, which was unheard of in the business in those days. And raw materials went up to something like, I don't know, 36 or something. So, and we established Kanbans for the first time. So all of these, you know, visual management was introduced. So all of these things that I'd been learning at the IMI and from visiting a couple of other sites, we just went to town on that. And suddenly we were a super performer. And we'd done all that against the background of a growing hostile IR environment, but we had the right people from the shop floor and from the warehouse involved in the project to keep that neutral. So they saw the benefits and were supporting it and kept the hostile IR people away from it.
Those benefits, of course, and that experience education you had led to it, like, ultimately was a 40-year career in manufacturing plants and improving supply chains and developing suppliers as well, and particularly turning around poor performing factories. We're going to touch into how you did that. I'm going to take a quick break on that first as well. I do note that you've mentioned some terms that are associated with lean, like Kanban and Kaizen, and you also kind of feel sometimes we overdo it with the kind of lean lingo, that it's about bringing it really back to basic principles with your employees. So after a break, we'll touch on the kind of leadership piece as well and culture change and talk more in depth about your book. Stay tuned. My guest here is Liam Cassidy, the author of Make Your Factory Great and Keep It That Way. Liam will be still here after this quick break. Still to come on Taking Care of Business, why Peter Bracken from Offaly has decided to go to travel in a fully electric car to all the rugby clubs across the country. And you'll find out how you can nominate your favourite venue, your favourite bar, favourite restaurant, favourite server, favourite chef, whatever it might be, in the Midlands 103 Hospitality Awards that were launched just yesterday. But at the minute, I'm here in studio joined by Liam Cassidy. Liam is the author of Make Your Factory Great and Keep It That Way. He's over 40 years experience in turning around factories, not just in Ireland or the UK, but right across the world as well. Before the break, Liam was bringing us up to speed with his own experience. He was a GM with the GE Group as well. And that kind of really was starting that whole drive towards lean and really seeing about how you can examine processes and start to shape around processes within a factory and in turn factories and warehouses. Experience that took him then across the globe. Liam, bring us from your time with GE right up to the stage where you became out and out. You're a consultant in your own right.
I then moved to Orebee Laboratories in Newbridge. I was recruited by the GM at that time, Kevin Conroy, a dynamo of a man, and he wanted me to introduce world-class manufacturing, which later became lean. And, to fast forward a bit, we just made that a terrific factory. It got loads of attention from the rest of the organization and from the Gillette Corporation. It was a division of the Gillette Corporation. And we just made it the best factory in the group. And using the lean package, which is called the lean package today, the lean philosophy, putting people at the center, getting them involved in the design of their workplace, getting their opinions, giving them a voice and that is listened to and responded to. In very early 2000, then I was asked to go to the Iowa City plant to prepare for a closure announcement within 2 years. And I said that was the Orebee plant, the largest toothbrush facility in the world, but it had resisted or just not introduced new practices and very traditional, and their costs were out of control. Not out of control, but they were falling behind every other site, and including Mexico, and China was coming up fast on the other lane at that time. So I said I would go, but only on the basis if I could implement a turnaround, because I felt I'd been there, I felt it had potential. So I did, and again, the lean philosophy, get the people involved, the people that never, really been asked what their opinions were, used the whole visible management thing, and put in the whole lean package. And in 2 years, it was the best factory within the Gillette organization.
And was it engaging the people was the key piece of it? Like, how did you overcome? I'm sure there was a lot of resistance.
Yeah, there was initially because they didn't know that the factory was going to close, although the project had been around for 2 years and my predecessor had not communicated that to them. So I communicated in my second week. There was a lot of hostility because they didn't believe it. But then I plastered the notice boards with communications and going back that was confirming this. And then I said, look, we can do this. We can attempt a turnaround. I think it is potential, but I need you with me. And I brought in, tried and trusted people that I knew could help me, third-party people. And we just, the workforce responded terrifically well to being involved and being communicated to. They had never been so before. And a lot of them would have come from farming backgrounds. Iowa City is a small city. Probably 60% of the workforce would have grown up on farms. So I called them the best unskilled workforce that I'd ever worked with. So that really got the attention of Gillette. And I then came back to Ireland to after 4 years to take over what was then the Ireland campus, because the Braun and Oral-B divisions, both Gillette divisions, had been merged, and Oral-B was part of the Braun, was a sister plant of the Braun factory in Carlow. The Braun factory in Carlow had also fallen behind, resisted change. The unions were very strong, a lot of negative IR activity there. So we went in, I'd communicated directly to the workforce. I'd said, you know, I would always treat the representatives with respect, but they did not speak. You know, they were not between me and the workforce. I wanted to communicate directly with the workers. So I told them they had a choice. The factory was under grave threat. I felt we could turn it around. Implemented the same package. A year later, it was a terrific site. A year and a half, it was an even better site. And then during that time, Procter & Gamble acquired Gillette. So suddenly everything changed. They had a plant in Neenah, which was not well thought of, Procter & Gamble. And right away, there was rumours that they might close the plant in Newbridge and transfer to Eastern Europe and to Germany. But I got the senior person, the VP responsible for oral care, to come over from Cincinnati. She looked at what we were doing in Newbridge and then Carlow, loved it, went back home, and that threat went away. But so then I moved to China. After 2 years, I moved to the Braun plant in China, which was also under some threat. Made that a great factory, using the same methods of communications, the same lean tools. And then I think 6 years later, because, as you know, Ronan, when big organizations come together, there is always fallout and casualties. They're looking for mergers. They're looking for what can we do here? So the Neenah, the Carlow plant eventually was closed. But 150 jobs were transferred to Newbridge, and two of the really, really good products came up with it. So that was something. But sometimes, no matter what you do, it's not enough. Yeah. But in most cases, if you do the right things in factories, you will survive and thrive. Keep your costs down, invest in your workforce, love them. But lean is about also making people accountable, which is kind of confusing for people these days. Mm. You know, everybody should be held accountable for what they're responsible for. It doesn't matter what level they're at. The more urgent, the more senior those people they are. If leadership are not doing what they're supposed to do, you know, they're putting the site at risk. And I think that every senior manager there's a moral imperative to do the right thing for the greater good.
You've compiled that experience into a fantastic book that I have in front of me called Make Your Factory Great and Keep It That Way. How long did that take to put together, and what compelled you to put it into a book?
Well, some years ago, about 20 years ago, in fact, I didn't decide to write a book, but I've begun to figure out that factories don't have to close. You know, the every town in Ireland has a factory shell, which is a tragedy, because if a town is kept alive, even one factory will keep young people at home. And I grew up near Letterkenny, where factories came and went, and it was just considered normal. Mullingar, factories came and went, Tullamore, all over the country and all over England, and particularly north of England, Scotland. And then across the great Midwest, you know, when I went to live there in the USA. So why is it? It doesn't have to happen. If people do the right things, if you have products that the marketplace wants, and you can deliver them at the right price, why? And you keep improving your services every year, and you keep investing in your people, you will have a great workforce that's behind you, trying to do endeavoring to do the right things. So I figured out that factories didn't have to close, and that was at the root of me writing the book. It took me many years to do it, and COVID was a great opportunity. So I was going out of my mind with boredom, and so I got stuck into that and got it off my chest.
Well, I think we should thank you for that, because it's loaded with case studies there as well, and it has some of your background in terms of your upbringing, and particularly pays huge tribute to that military upbringing as well. Interestingly, nowadays, would a military background be valued as much if you were to go into a company?
Probably not. But I think in some parts of the world, yeah, probably, yeah. Still.
Yeah.
I think that, I still think that personal discipline and good habits are
and accountability,
you know, ageless,
yeah, and accountability, not just to your superiors, yeah, but also to, yeah, your teammates. I mean, it's the, yeah, it's the fundamental language of
manufacturing. I mean, I'm astonished sometimes at the lack of accountability. Sometimes, yeah, you know, I go into work organizations all the time, and sometimes it's even at senior levels, the accountability is as close to zero as you can get. Yeah. And it's a lot worse now than it was, I think, 20, yeah, 30 years
and
ago.
Of course, it can depend on the sector and the organisations, yeah, too, and all that. Liam, thank you so much for popping in this evening and sharing your knowledge as well. If anybody's looking for that book, it's Make Your Factory Great and Keep It That Way by Liam Cassidy. And it's available there on Amazon and all the various publishing channels too. Definitely worth checking out. Liam, thank you once again. Electric cars, electric vehicles, the growth of electric vehicles is a huge topic of interest lately. But what is it actually like? So what if you wanted to test out how good electric vehicles are and maybe suss out the infrastructure around the country? Well, one man that has done so is former professional rugby player and legendary Offaly man Peter Bracken. He's decided to go to every rugby club in the country in a fully electric car. That's 240 clubs, I believe. Peter, why, oh why, would you take on such a journey?
Hello, Ronan. Good to be on. Well, number one, for the absolute crack of it and the fun. I had a great holiday. I've always wanted to drive around Ireland and see the whole country in one go, and I've just done that. And I said, why not do an electric car and just show that electric cars are perfect for the island of Ireland? And yeah, I've hit 241 clubs. There was an extra club in the end. And it means I've gone to every nook and cranny and corner of Ireland, up north and south, and have had no issues. These cars can do the job. So if there's anyone thinking about changing, going for a new one or whatever, new car, yeah, go down the electric route. At least go for a test drive and you will be amazed. I've no problems charging. There's plenty of charging infrastructure out there. We always need to keep pressure on the government to keep rolling them out, and there's massive opportunities for sports clubs in the whole renewable side of things, but also for hotels and supermarkets and car parks and all that to get car chargers out there for an extra stream.
Well, that's it. Like, I mean, we're going to need them at all the clubs anyway, because if people are being urged to get electric vehicles. But you sound convinced there. But did you have to change how you planned your journeys, or was it just the same as driving a standard diesel or petrol car?
Well, for me, I'm not woefully organised on things. Like, if it comes to rugby, I'm very organised. But every day-to-day things, and I was in holiday mode. So, yeah, I planned a bit of a route, as you would, if I was driving a petrol or diesel car. But I did know more organisation than I would if I was driving a fossil fuel car. Took a general route, and I was saying, look, if I decide to go off route, go somewhere else, take a different course, which I had to do, because a wedding came up in the middle of it that I had forgotten about, that I had to get back from Belfast down to Gort and back again to get the journey in, and no problems. Look, as soon as you start driving an electric car, what you notice is all the chargers around the place. You never noticed them before that, and then you notice them, you know where they are, you have the app on the phone, the car is telling you where the chargers are. It's lightening up when you're getting close to, when you've maybe 20% full or whatever, that you might start looking at where to charge. And these apps will tell you which chargers are in operation, as in, if there's people charging at them already, well, then you go on to the next one. So it'll let you know ahead of time which ones are occupied and which ones are not. So, look, I didn't overly plan this, and I just went and did it. And yeah, it was brilliant, and I literally had no issues. I remember there was a lady in front of me, I think in Monaghan town, and she was just finishing up. So we had a chat for about 10 minutes before I started charging. Literally did 7,000 kilometres, and that's all that I had, the 10-minute delay. That was it. And at the end of it, I spent €505 on electricity, which would be the equivalent in the same car, petrol or diesel, that would have cost me €1,300. So even using the fast chargers, which are the most expensive way of charging an electric car, it's still 2.5 times cheaper. And if you're charging at home, which 90% of the charges you do, if you're driving electric, you're actually charging at home. You're charging at night time and the car's ready to go in the morning. It'd actually be 5, 6, 7, 8 times dearer or cheaper to go electric, if depending on what tariff you have or whatever. So rule of thumb, right now at the moment, the way electricity prices are and the way fuel prices are, it was working out for me that electric car was 2.5 times cheaper to fuel on the public chargers and 5 times cheaper if I was to charge at home.
Wow. You're not doing anything to convince the naysayers here in this one. I thought you'd be telling us a story of the car stopping and having to wait for somebody to come with an emergency battery pack and all that, but it sounds far from it. So what was the message then you were trying to bring to these rugby clubs, and what sort of questions were they asking you when you got there?
Well, I suppose I was arriving in an electric car, and big thanks goes to Ron Hogan from Frank Hogan Motors in Limerick, who gave me the car for 4.5 weeks to do this journey. So it's very hard to get a car off anyone for 4.5 weeks, and he gave me the charging car with it. So only for Hogan's in Limerick, I wouldn't have been able to do it. So fair play to them. And so arriving in an electric car, and we got chatting about the electric cars, but I was really there to have a look at how, two things, what's going on biodiversity and kind of nature-wise within rugby clubs in Ireland, and also to see what clubs are doing to cut costs by going green and go more environmentally friendly and get that conversation going. And I was really presently surprised. There's actually an awful lot more going on than I thought there would be. 70 or 80% of clubs have a biodiversity verge or hedges or are doing something along those lines. Clubs are realizing that you don't have to cut every inch of blade of grass and banks and all that. Just let it go wild, and it cuts costs and it helps the birds and the bees and all the rest. And biodiversity now is in people's minds. So if there's a bit of a patch with wildflowers, people don't think it's untidy anymore. They might have thought that maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but now people realise that's the reason we're doing it. And the flowers are pretty and they're beautiful, and clubs are really getting behind that. And also, the other thing was to take a look at how they're cutting costs. And there's a lot of clubs doing a lot. There's solar, a lot of clubs using solar. There's a lot of clubs using solar to hot water storage for showers. I would say 60% of the clubs, rugby clubs in Ireland now, have changed from normal floodlights, which absolutely hemorrhage money. They've changed to LED lights, which cuts the cost in half pretty much. That's the feedback I've been getting from most clubs, and they're actually LED lights are better. They're better for players. You can play better matches on them. So there's an awful lot that clubs can do and are doing. So I was taking a look at that, and one club stood out to me. A lot of clubs stood out, but one club that really have a great thing going, I think this can be it can be easily, every club can do this. But basically, Crosshaven Rugby Club in Cork, medium-sized club. There's literally 2 solar panels on top of their changing rooms. And they have those solar panels heating 2 hot water storage heaters in the dressing room. And they have not paid for grid electricity to heat the showers since they've installed that. And that's literally only 2 panels and 2 big water tanks. That water stays hot. So, and the showers will be used, 4 or 5 times a week. And, so the solar panels may have 24 hours to, the water's used, the team comes in, plays a match, and next thing, oh, Ginny, 24 hours later, there's training on. So it gives solar panels enough time to heat the water again, and then there's showers and just hot water. Because what I've learned is showers and lighting, like floodlights and even indoor lighting, are the main energy costs for clubs. So the number one thing I got was the lowest hanging fruit for rugby clubs is if you've just normal floodlights, you can cut costs immediately by going green, by changing to LED lights. And the second thing is solar to hot water. Throw up the solar panels, get the storage water tanks in, you'll have basically, once that's paid for, you're going to have free hot water for showers for years and years.
Well done. Well, what a great message to get out and spread across all 241 rugby clubs. It sounds like you had great fun doing it, Peter. And It sounds like a blast. It's something I might try and do myself. If anybody wants to give me a car for 4 weeks and get me 4 weeks off work, that'd be fantastic. But Peter, well done again. Thank you so much for coming on and telling your story. That's Peter Bracken there. If you look him up across social media, Peter Tries, or the Scrum Coach as well, he's very recognisable. You probably all know him anyway. And you can look back at some of the videos from his journey there too, and get his key learnings as he's gone through there. Time for a quick break. After that, the Hospitality Awards are back, and what a great way to celebrate and award some of those businesses in a sector that was so badly hit by COVID-19. Find out how you can nominate people after this break. You would have just caught that ad there for the Hospitality Awards. They're back, and God knows it's a sector that deserves a chance for some recognition and a bit of celebration. 51 categories overall. Winners will be announced at a gala ball in the Midlands Park Hotel on the 14th of November. Co-founder of the awards, Brian Cunningham, joins me now. Brian, a great chance for celebration. Take us through some of the main categories.
Good evening to you, Ronan, and good evening to all the listeners. Yeah, very exciting time, so it is, Ronan. Back again, we obviously, since 2019 was our last one we had in the Midlands, obviously some great categories, some great new categories, and we're looking for the best hotels, best restaurants and best bars in the Midlands region. And I know when we did this in 2019, we got such a huge response. And again, I know it's going to be, no doubt, the listeners will really engage with us as they did the last time and vote for their favourite hotel, their favourite restaurant, their favourite bar, and their live music attraction, and of course, tourism attractions as well. So we're really excited about it. It's great to see it back. And of course, we're looking for the listeners' help, as always, again, to vote in that range of categories, you know.
And get in and vote early, because anyone you talk to, all these categories, people can tell you off the top of their head where their favourite venue is, where their favourite, who their favourite chef is, their best leisure centre, their best heritage site and all that. So it's just a case of getting on to midlands103.com and logging that vote, isn't it? It's that simple.
Very, very simple. And of course, you know, go on to midlands103.com. You can vote in the range of categories. If you don't have access to the computer and you're listening to us, don't fret. Send us in a letter with your favourite place and we'll get it registered as well. And of course, a fabulous host of judges coming in the hotel section, the restaurant section and the bar section. And of course, well-known household names like Joe Shannon, Tim Husbands, obviously the chief executive of Leopardstown Racecourse and formerly managing director of the Titanic in Belfast, Roisin Wallace Group, director of operations at the Regional Irish Hotels, Sally Ann Clark, the Michelin star restaurateur, Richie Wilson, executive head chef in Fire Restaurant, Peter Wilson, who many will know from the Lyrath Estate, but now general manager of Avalon House Hotel, Paul Fitzsimons from the Burlington Hotel in Dublin, Ray Hingston from Enhance, and Andrew Fisher, general manager of House in Dublin as well. So they'll be there as the judges, and of course, chairperson of the judging panel is Megan White, and of course, it's going to be from White's Hotels. So it's going to be really exciting. It's going to be something that's I know it's going to be a good crack. It's always something that we really look forward to, and of course, as I said, the listeners always do their job properly.
Absolutely, and I know there's usually thousands of nominations, and I don't expect to be any different this year as well. In about 10 seconds, Brian, you have a very special award, obviously, this year too. Take us through that.
We have a very special award. Obviously, former managing director at Midlands 103, Albert Fitzgerald, passed 3 weeks ago. And obviously, Fitzy, or Albert, was so vitally important to the Hospitality Awards and helped us in every way possible with the Hospitality Awards. The Albert Award is going to be recognising someone in sales and marketing contribution to the tourism industry. And this award is going to be a national-based award. It's going to be put out around the country as well. And it's going to be recognising, of course, Siobhan, his wife, and Stephen and Andrew, his two sons, will be there to present it on
Absolutely
the night as well.
Absolutely fantastic. And how fitting that it's a sales team award as well. Brian, it sounds fantastic. 100%. We'll talk to you all soon. And thank you for that update on that as well. So as Brian said, Midlands103.com, go on there. It's very simple. Go to the process, nominate those favourite people, those favourite venues, hotels, restaurants, bars, tourist attractions, whatever they might be. Get voting and give those people a well-earned night out, and let's try and forget about costs and operational costs for one night and have a great night's crack. Stay safe. I'll talk to you all next week from 7 p.m.
Taking Care of Business returns next Tuesday at 7 p.m. with the local enterprise offices of Leash, Offaly and Westmeath. Find us on localenterprise.ie and let's talk business.